How many of you have ever played the game Battleship?
Yes.
Battleship. Play this game. Play it as a kid. Play it as an adult. Whatever. Originally, this game was a pencil and paper public domain game. Anybody could play. You just grab pencil and paper, draw out your grid, place your ships, and you can get to work. And then in 1967, Milton Bradley purchased the rights, turned it into the popular board game that many of us know. Now you can get the electronic ones where it's got explosion sounds, and it's just a whole lot of hullabaloo. But Battleship is fundamentally a game about hiding and attacking, right? Like, you've got your fleet, you place it on a grid. Some of you, when you were kids, maybe you cheated and you tried to stack the pieces all together on the same space, so they just had to keep hitting that space. But you hide your fleet and you try and attack theirs. And the objective is to sink all of their ships before they can sink yours, right? Battleship. Now, here's the thing. So many human relationships are just like this game. We hide and we attack, especially if we feel threatened, right? When we're vulnerable, when we feel angry, when we feel like we've been mistreated, we're getting ready to fire up our torpedoes. And we think, well, okay, well, if you're going to attack me, if you're going to try and sink my ship, I better fire first and sink yours, right? We can do this at work. We can do this relationally, at home, work, school, wherever. I mean, we have this tendency as humans to hide and attack. We play battleship in our relationships. And we've been going through this series called Kingdom Manifesto, right? The Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' sermon in Matthew 5 through 7. And what we're going to learn today is that he's got some key ideas that kind of challenges this hide and attack method that some of us adopt, especially when we're angry, especially when we feel like we've been mistreated or anything like that. Now, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus does make it clear to his audience that he's not come to contradict the Old Testament law, what they would call the law of Moses. He's not come to contradict it. But he's not here to leave it unchanged or preserved the way it is either. If you have your Bibles, open up to Matthew 5. That's where we're going to spend this morning, starting in verse 17. If you don't have them, that's fine. It'll be up on the screen. This is Jesus talking. And he says this. He says, "Do not think I have come to abolish the law or the prophets," what we would call the Old Testament. "I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." All right, so Jesus says, he says a lot of things here, but what we want to focus on this morning is Jesus says he's here to fulfill the law, or in other words, bring it to its intended goal, its intended purpose, what it was originally trying to do. You see, Jesus didn't come because the law was terrible or it was bad. Jesus came to fulfill the law so that all of a sudden, he was the most important thing. Not a list was the most important thing. So Jesus begins to look at these laws and he says, "I'm here to fulfill it. I'm not going to contradict it." But why is he saying these things? Because he's preparing his audience for what he's about to say, where he's going to be overriding some Old Testament thinking, where he's going to reference an Old Testament law and he's going to bring some correction or bring some fulfillment to it. He's going to bring it back to its intended purpose. You know, and such a statement by Jesus to say, "I have come to fulfill the law," was either astonishingly arrogant or astonishingly authoritative, depending on who Jesus was. If Jesus wasn't the Son of God, such a statement would be incredibly arrogant for him to make. But because he is the Son of God, he speaks with incredible authority. And he begins to overwrite several known Old Testament laws, laws of Moses. And these are called scholars call the six antitheses, right? Six antitheses. That's kind of fun to say. Say it with me. Six antitheses. There you go. And what we see in these six antitheses is when Jesus says, you have heard it said, but I say to you, right? And there's six of them that he makes in the next few sections. And all of these six antitheses, I'm just going to keep saying it because it's fun. All of these six antitheses all address relationships. They all address relationships. Why? Well, simply put, because the Pharisees believed you were righteous because of your right beliefs and your right rituals. They thought that's how you become righteous. But Jesus shows up and says, right relationships with God show up in the way we relate and treat people. And how we relate and treat people starts with what's in our hearts. He says, I'm going to change something on you guys. You think it's about right rituals. It's not. It's about relationship. This is Matthew 5, starting in verse 21. Again, this is Jesus talking. He says, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, raka, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother and sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. This is super encouraging. So here's the thing. We've heard the saying, don't get mad, get even. But Jesus says, don't get mad, get righteous. Get righteous. Like Moses, Jesus condemns murder, obviously. But then he goes on to claim that harboring anger in one's heart against her brother or sister is also sinful and deserving of punishment. Now, when you read the phrase brother or sister or brother and sister in the book of Matthew, it's referring to spiritual brothers and sisters. So he's saying, if you harbor any anger towards a fellow follower of me, if you hold anger towards a fellow spiritual brother and sister, you're subject to judgment. And the Greek word thymos, where we get one of the root words for our word thermonuclear, is the Greek word for anger. And it's an anger that flares up like a flame and then dies down, kind of like an You know, most of us feel this when we drive, right? I tell you what, the worst drive in the world is when I go to drop my kid off at school in the morning. I can't stand that drive. And I get challenged. When I was preparing for this message and I had that drive, I was challenged on a daily basis by this reality. You know, because it flares up, you're mad, you honk your horn, and then it just kind of subsides. But plot twist, this isn't the word that Jesus uses when he talks about anger. There's another Greek word, orge, which we get another very specific English word, refers to an anger that's nurtured. It's a passionate anger that's nurtured to the point where it agitates your very soul. It's an anger that threatens to leap out of control, leading to violence, emotional hurt, increased mental stress, spiritual damage, and yes, even murder. You ever been angry like that? You've ever been mistreated to the point where you're angry and it just sits there and it sits there and you let it, you feed it, you nurture it, and then it just starts filling up your life. And now every time you think about this person, every time you see this person, you're just agitated in your soul. You have mental distress, you have spiritual damage, and the act of doing something violent to them has probably crossed your mind. And then Jesus continues, he says, anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fires of hell. You know, I remember hearing this when I was younger, and it kind of stressed me out. I was really worried about this because I have older sisters. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, Jake, never call Sarah or Julia a fool. I better just stick with stupid. But the term raka is an Aramaic word that means void or empty. It's actually a contractual word that means like a contract is null and void. It's worthless. It's useless. And it was used when a Jewish rabbi would excommunicate someone. It was also used as a general insult by other people. However, it carries with it an implication that the person being called raka, which is another fun word to say, has lost their value as a human. They are a nothing, a nobody. Their existence is void. So what's Jesus talking about here? He's talking about mean-spiritedness, cutting remarks. He's talking about cynicism when we're angry. And those are some ways that we hide and attack. Those are some of the ways we play battleship in our lives. Now, he's not condemning every joke or every jest, but what he's warning us against is nurturing a personal animosity towards somebody that devalues their very life, that devalues them as people, especially our spiritual brothers and sisters. You see, just as murder is literally the devaluing of life, so too can rooted animosity and anger lead us to devaluing somebody's life. And that's why Jesus says, listen, you've heard murder's bad, but let me tell you, if you nurture anger and you devalue somebody's life with what you say, it's also bad. This is also a problem. You know, we see this often in the social media world when it comes to specifically political opinions, right? And some of the most scathing rebukes and cutting remarks that one side of a debate will sling at the other. It doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on, both are guilty of it. Right? And all of a sudden, you follow these conversations and these debates, and they fade from dealing with the issue, and they become character assessment and assassination. You're no longer talking about the issue. Now you're focusing on the person, and you start making assessments about their character and their integrity. How can you call yourself a Christian and you think this? How can you call yourself a Christian and you think this? How can you think yourself an educated person, but you hold this opinion? How can you do this, but believe this? How can you? And we start firing off torpedoes, right? We grow entrenched in our own thoughts, in our own opinions. We try and sink their battleship before they sink ours. All because we place our own opinions and our own understanding of human-defined rights as being more important and being elevated above God-given value of every person in existence. We place our own opinions over the inherent value of every person. That's how we hide and attack. And you could see why Jesus would have a problem with this thinking. You can see why he's like, listen, we've got to change some of this. With this way of dealing with anger, you know, he's got to change it because they were fine just not to kill somebody. He's like, no, what you do in your anger matters. But you have to understand the issue here isn't being angry in and of itself. Jesus got angry. We read that he went into the temple and he got mad and he started tossing over the tables. He made a whip to drive out the livestock. This wasn't like he walked in and was like, oh, what in the name of me is going on here? He made a whip before he went in. He knew what he was about to do. So it's not about getting angry, but it's about what we do in our anger that matters, that Jesus is trying to bring correction to. Jesus wants us to deal decisively with our anger, and he gives us two examples to illustrate his point. First, he envisions a worshiper to whom he says, before you come to offer your sacrifice at the altar to worship, first go and be reconciled with someone who has something against you. Now, the presumption is that it's something legitimate, that you have done something to wrong them, let them down, injure them in some way, so that they have something against you. Not you have something against them. They have something against you, and you leave your offering to go and make it right. Jesus says, before you complete your act of worship, go make it right with them, and then come and worship. Why? Because the Pharisees thought right rituals were more important. But God thinks right relationships are more important. You see, right relationships are more important than right rituals. How you treat people matters more than how you worship. Because if you're treating people right, if you're focused on right relationships and reconciliation, it will improve your own worship. The second example Jesus gives is an out-of-court settlement between litigants. He's saying, don't go to court with this person that you have a dispute with. Settle up. Settle out of court. Because if you go to court, it may go badly for you. You may have to pay a penalty. You may get in prison. This may not end well for you. So settle up before you even get there. It wasn't uncommon back then that litigants, people who are court adversaries, would walk together on the way to a hearing or to a court appearance. And the idea was that they would be given themselves a chance to settle up before they even reached court. So Jesus says, walk with these litigants. Walk with your adversary. Walk next to them and bring reconciliation before you even hit the courtroom when they have something against you. You take the initiative. You have to understand that Jesus is completely rewriting the expectation of healthy and righteous relationships. Before this moment, the Pharisees and religious leaders were happy to leave it at do not murder, right? As long as you didn't kill the dude, you were in obedience to the law and therefore clean and in good standing with the Lord. But Jesus says, no, not killing somebody is like the bare minimum here. Like, we didn't kill him, Jesus. We're good. Well, no, like, guys, like, I shouldn't have to tell you don't kill anybody. That's like the bare minimum for just human decency, right? But we want active and vital relationships. He says it's bigger than that. It's deeper than that. It's the relationship that matters most. And if you know someone has something against you, you go and address it. You take the initiative to bring peace and reconciliation. As we heard a couple weeks ago from Jesus in the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers. Don't just go on with your life saying, well, they're the ones with the problem. If they don't want to deal with it, then I'm not going to go after it. It's their problem. You ever done that before? It's not my problem. You're the one with the problem. Why should I have to deal with it? You want reconciliation? You come to me. You got a problem with me? You should say something. Jesus is like, no, don't do that. You go to the person first. You take the initiative. Because if you want part of my kingdom, you've got to put relationships as the most important thing. You've got to bring reconciliation. You've got to be a peacemaker. It's not enough to simply not kill people. You've got to love people. Again, not killing somebody is kind of it's a pretty low standard. I was a good person. I didn't kill anybody. That's not really a gauge that we want to live by. And Jesus says, you have to love people, and you have to bring peace. 2 Corinthians 5:18 says, God has reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. Now, this is Paul talking, but all of us have the ministry of reconciliation. If you are a follower of Jesus, you have the responsibility, the calling, the ministry of being a peacemaker. of bringing reconciliation where reconciliation needs to happen. You see, it says that God is a peacemaker, and he has made peace with us through Jesus. Now he has given us the ministry of being a peacemaker. And when you attempt to be a peacemaker, you're doing the work of God. When you're restoring relationships, you're emulating the heart of God. So let me ask you, where do you need to take the initiative to bring reconciliation in your life? Where does somebody have something against you that you need to take the initiative and say, let's reconcile. Let's make this right. I want to bring peace. I want my life to be defined by peace. There's so many people in this world who have been hurt or damaged or offended by people who call themselves Christians. And we've got a heavy job as followers of Jesus to bring reconciliation to the world that's like, listen, I've heard it before, and you bring nothing but pain because you've put ritual above relationship. We all have the ministry of reconciliation, both as followers of Jesus and as individuals. So where in your life do you need to bring reconciliation? Where have you placed ritual above relationship? Where has anger caused you to devalue someone else? You know, over the next 3 weeks, we're going to be looking at the remaining five of these six antitheses, these Old Testament law rewrites. And we're going to see something really interesting about what Jesus is doing. Because Jesus wants us to understand that it's not about our rights. It's not about what we're owed. It's not about restitution. It's not about rituals. It's about righteousness. It's about reconciliation and understanding that right relationships are key to emulating the heart of God for all people. He says, in your anger, be careful, because we're all going to get angry. But what that anger drives you to do is what Jesus is addressing. He says, if your anger leads you to devalue someone, it's just as bad as killing them, because you've removed their God-given value. Because when he died on the cross, he established the value that all human life is worth, right? And so when we devalue somebody, we devalue his cross. Because if we say, you're nothing, you're nobody, you don't contribute anything, your existence is void, we call him Raka. We cheapen the cross because now the cross doesn't mean anything. This is a problem if you're a follower of Jesus. And that's why he addresses it. He says, some of you are okay at the bare minimum of just not killing people, but how you treat people shows your relationship and how you view God. And if you're going to be a brother or sister, if you're going to follow me, how you treat others, especially when you're angry, matters. Because relationships matter most. And that's why he rewrites these six Old Testament laws. Because before they address a relationship issue, they first identify a heart issue. And he says, in the Old Testament, that law of Moses is supposed to put you guys on track. And you've used it to just do the bare minimum. And you've placed a list as more important than a life. He says that's not what the kingdom of heaven is going to be about. You want to take part in my kingdom, you have to emulate the heart of God for all people. And that starts here. It starts simply with how we deal with our anger. and what that anger drives us to do or don't do, and our desire to be peacemakers, to bring reconciliation. Because it's not about rights, it's about righteousness. Let's pray.